for coming. I'm going to go ahead and introduce our next presenters. They will take us through to the lunch hour. First, we have Tina Edlund, who has the privilege of being the acting director of the Oregon Health Authority. We had planned on having Bruce Goldberg here, but as we all know, he has a new temporary assignment with Cover Oregon. And after Tina, we have Pam Martin, who is the head of alcohol addictions and mental health with OHA, and Greg Roberts, who is the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital. Like Pete and our other presenters, you'll find more information about them on our bio page. So I'm going to hand it over to Tina. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. It's great to see such a big crowd out on a day like this, although it is warmer in here than it is outside, so that's a good thing. You know, it's hard to follow somebody like the last speaker. He was so compelling and interesting, and what I have to share with you is probably a little bit drier, but it's really pertinent to the discussion that we just heard, that a lot of the way the health system is designed in this country and in this state actually works against the kind of integration and the kind of delivery of services that's needed in order to really address behavioral health issues and get good outcomes. I'm going to start. My presentation is going to focus in the beginning about what we're doing in Oregon and our health system transformation in Oregon. We have been working on this for a lot of years. People get it confused with what we're doing federally with the Affordable Care Act, but in fact, Oregon has been working on this for a long, long time. So the first reason that we've been working on it as hard as we have is because healthcare is just increasingly expensive and we can't afford it anymore. It's not sustainable. As the cost of healthcare goes up, what happens is more and more people drop out of care. The uninsured rate goes up, and the higher the uninsured rate goes, it creates this terrible, terrible cycle of costs that aren't covered by anyone, services that can't be delivered efficiently. Health outcomes actually decline in a situation where we have these increasing costs. This slide basically shows, it really draws a fine point on how bad the situation is. Since 1960, the cost of healthcare has increased by 818%. At the same time, wages have grown at 16%. The gross national product has grown at 168%. It's clearly not sustainable. You can't have that kind of increasing gap without creating a lot of new uninsured people. This, at the same time, healthcare spending on a per capita, or actually this is the total healthcare spending, has increased again. It's, you know, that same line we all see. Actually, Bruce Goldberg, who was supposed to be here today, used to always say, you only have one graph in healthcare, and that's this one. It's everything goes up. The number of uninsured going up, the costs going up. That is a graph that we could use that one graph and make several points off of it. This is the other pressure that's on the system, is Medicare is growing. The percentage of people who will be covered by Medicare is in 2000 was about 14% of the population. It's projected that it'll be about 21% in 2025. Again, it creates just yet another pressure on the underlying costs in the system. So this is how we typically balance this issue in healthcare, and we've done it over and over and over again in the Medicaid program. You have a choice. You can cut people from care, which we've done when we in 2003, when we took the OHP standard population, and literally within 6 months, 60,000 people dropped out of coverage. That was simply a case of cutting people from care. We can cut provider rates. Again, there's a limit to how much you can do that. You keep cutting provider rates, they drop out of the system. They don't want to take Medicaid clients anymore. They don't want to see them. Or you can cut services. And again, you can get to a point where, you know, the soup is just too thin. You can spread it so far, but at some point there's a baseline of services that need to be provided. So what we did and what the governor did was he looked at that, and it's something that he's believed in for a whole long time now, and that is that there's a fourth path, that all the national studies, all the work that anyone does shows that there's about 30% of our total spending in the system is waste. so we can reorganize how we deliver services and look at the sources of waste and drive that waste out of the system and get better outcomes. So we reduce waste, we improve health, we create local accountability, and that's really key to what we're doing in Oregon, is it's that local community accountability, because no one understands the local health care needs of the local population better than the people who live there. We try to align our financial incentives so we're actually paying, instead of paying for volume, we pay for outcomes. You know, right now, the way the world works right now, the only way a provider gets paid is someone has to show up. There has to be a visit of some kind. We need to fundamentally change that and start shifting toward paying for value and for the outcomes that we want. And we need to, as I said, we need to create fiscal sustainability. It doesn't serve anyone well if the cost of the system continue to outstrip the money that we raise in taxes or the income that individuals earn. Right now, we're in a situation where the pressure is such that we're actually, as healthcare costs go up in the state, we see resources available for education, resources available for public safety, all start to shrink as healthcare takes a bigger and bigger portion of the budget. The next reason, you can't quite hear. Okay. Oh, better. I can even hear that it's better. So, and the next issue that we deal with in our healthcare transformation, health system transformation in Oregon, is that really just focusing on healthcare alone is really the wrong part of the puzzle. That only about 10% of our total health outcomes can really be dealt with in a healthcare environment. That most of it is really about the environment. It's about the social determinants of health. It's about who your parents were. It's about the lifestyle choices that you make, behavior choices you make. You choose to eat too much, you choose to smoke too much, or smoke at all. And those are really much bigger predictors of health outcomes than the actual medical care you get. And yet that's where all the money is in that little 10% wedge. So, and we also know that addressing issues around behavioral health are really key to getting the kind of outcomes that we want. This is some analysis that was done in 2011 showed that people accessing addiction treatment, the people who needed it, accessing addiction treatment, decreased costs about $3,000 per year. That's big. That's when you multiply that times the number of people who actually need those services in the state, that's really big and a big piece of driving down those costs and getting better outcomes. It's the kind of work that we want to continue to do and to look at those opportunities. Where spending more in one area actually saves the entire system money. And we all know that this math here in this bottom bullet is really important to what we're doing as well, and that is that about 20% of the people drive 80% of the costs. So if we really focus there, a lot of us people with severe and multiple chronic conditions who can be treated with team-based patient-centered care, again, another tenet of what we're doing. So this is the face of what we're trying to do. I'm going to show you three different people here in three different cases. This is a little boy named Malik. He had asthma. He was going to the hospital on the average of 2 times a month because his asthma would get triggered by different, it would be triggered by perfume, it would be triggered by cigarette smoke, it would be triggered by dust. When the Healthy Homes program in Multnomah County, which is this incredible program, When they intervened, when he was connected with them, they were able to send a Healthy Homes representative, basically a community health worker, out into his home to basically do an environmental scan for what are the triggers for his asthma, what's setting him off. Once that was done and they were able to actually get him on the appropriate medications, get him access to that, get the triggers cleared out of his environment, he didn't return to the emergency room again. Malik is an incredible success story and exactly the kind of direction we want to go in. This is Ted Hanberg. Ted Hanberg is the sort of the other end of the spectrum. He was 83 years old when this was taken. It's a couple years old. He lives out in Happy Valley. He has congestive heart failure. He'd had 8 heart attacks. He was in and out of the hospital all the time. They put him, he got connected to a patient-centered primary care home with team-based care where that had specialists and social workers and the, and his primary care doctor. They all knew exactly what his health status was and what was going on with him. He has this, there's actually a video on our website of him talking about his experience where he could say any member of his team he could call and they knew exactly what was going on with him. He felt cared for, he felt protected. His costs of care and his health status changed dramatically, and again, he wasn't going back in the hospital for his congestive heart failure. This is a man named St. Clair. St. Clair has severe and persistent mental illness. He was in the hospital over 40 times in 2011, not for his mental illness, however. He was in the hospital 40 times for his asthma. So he is associated with Central City Concern. What they did was set up a system where he could come in every morning and he could get his medications. He would socialize with people. His cost of care for in 2011, because of all the hospitalizations associated with his asthma, and there were, I think, a couple hospitalizations for his schizophrenia, were around $100,000. By putting a team around him, giving him the opportunity to socialize, putting in a system where he could get his treatment regularly, the cost to do that was a little over $12,000 for a year. So this can be done. You can actually give better care, wrap around the person, be patient-centered, and get lower costs. So this is the current state of affairs in healthcare in the state and where we're trying to go. Again, as I said, the payment models are we pay for quantity now. We want to actually get to a system where we're paying for outcomes, paying for quality, and paying for health instead of paying for healthcare. We want to put incentives in place that actually reward people for getting those outcomes. We want to step back a little bit and say, let's not pay for every widget and every procedure. Let's actually look at what kind of outcomes we're looking for. And then we have metrics, which are just measures of success of progress. We want to hold people accountable for the care that we expect that we're buying as purchasers. So the way we've done this in Oregon, this is the governor's vision, the legislature's vision, was to create create this coordinated care model of healthcare in Medicaid first. So that was where we started. We had an incredible, they've all been up and going for about a year now. We had this incredible summit, CCO summit yesterday. Over 600 people were there. They shared their stories of success, the stories of innovation that they're undertaking out in their local communities, and it's really exciting work. It was a great day to hear the progress people have made. So there are 16 CCOs in the state now. Every part of the state is covered. There are 95% of the Medicaid population are enrolled in CCOs. CCOs are all locally governed. They're governed by a partnership among the healthcare providers, the local community. There are community advisory councils that are required as part of the governance structure of every single CCO. And a member of that advisory council actually is required to sit on the board of the CCO. So it really drives that accountability down at the community level and community input. Their mental health, physical health, and dental health are all integrated. Our previous system, those were all in separate silos. They were managed care, but they were in separate silos. And so you have all the administrative costs, all the multiple case managers, all the incredible complexity of having three different systems. So now these are integrated. They're integrated. There's a variety. Any of you who work with CCOs know that there's a range of levels of integration for this work. Some are really pretty much at the end of the spectrum where they're getting pretty well integrated, and others are just starting that work. So, and that's exactly what we expected. We expected to see sort of the whole continuum as people set up these models. They're responsible for outcomes. We have metrics that we hold the CCOs accountable to.
They can qualify for a quality bonus at the end of the year if they achieve those metrics. We have specific metrics around drug and alcohol screening, around hospitalization, follow-up after hospitalization for mental health issues. I think a lot of the metrics, the 17 metrics, they are aimed at the Medicaid population. So we see metrics around maternal and child health. Half the children born in the state of Oregon are born on Medicaid, paid for by Medicaid. So we have a lot of children's and maternal and child health metrics, and then a lot around substance abuse and mental health. They are capped. Part of our agreement with the federal government, I don't know if you all remember, but a couple years ago, the federal government agreed to invest $1.9 billion in our health system transformation. But there was, as the governor said yesterday, there was another side to that handshake. And the other side of that handshake was, you're accountable for quality, and we're going to hold you to that. We're not going to let you skate by on save this money at the foot of quality. And you need to control costs. So we're constrained to no more than 3.4% increase every year. And there are penalties that apply to us if we don't keep that deal. So this is the transparency piece. The CCOs are accountable for 33, well actually this says CCOs are accountable. The state is accountable for 33 measures of health and performance. The CCOs are accountable for a subset of that, 17. These are all available. If you want to go look at the detail around these metrics, it's all available at health.oregon.gov. So there's more information than you could possibly ever want out there. They're reported quarterly and posted on our on that website. We also have the CCO financial data is also reported out there. This is the kind of thing we see by CCO, this is baseline data, what the emergency room use was. And I'll go over a little bit in just a second, the preliminary numbers for what's happened since the CCOs have formed is looking really positive in this area, that we're seeing emergency department use go down, we're seeing primary care use go up, emergency department costs are going down, primary care costs are going up, which is exactly what we wanted to see. So this is a quick summary of the kinds of things we're seeing, reducing the unnecessary ER visits. These are the kinds of initiatives that the CCOs are undertaking. Some CCOs are putting community health workers in the EDs at the local hospitals so that when someone comes in who's one of their clients, who should have a primary care provider should have a patient-centered primary care home, they can actually intervene at that point and connect them to that, because sometimes people just don't know that they have that. They're developing complex care models for patients with chronic and complex conditions. They're creating complex care clinics for those patients. They're doing a lot of work around that, around the people who are the most severely ill. So this is, again, I won't go, I've said most of this, these are the kinds of approaches that they're taking. These are kinds of the hallmarks of the CCO model to focus on chronic disease management, really focus on primary care and upstream prevention. Let's stop that the issue before it gets to the point where people feel like they need to be in the emergency department. Now, this is a really important piece to what we're doing. It's just I only have one, maybe two slides on this, but I do think it's really important to emphasize that. We have created something called a Transformation Center. And what that does is it runs learning collaboratives where the CCOs and hopefully the larger delivery system as we get going, they can all come together and share best practices. Because what we're starting to see is we're seeing areas of the state where they're trying things and they're experiencing really incredible success. We want them to be able to come back and share that with other CCOs. We know that what works in Burns isn't going to necessarily work in Portland and vice versa, or that what works in Baker might not work in Prineville. But for them to come together and talk about how it's working in their community and what might be applicable in the other community is really invaluable. It's been exciting to see some of that work start up. So these are some results to date. Every CCO is living within their global budget, we're achieving our bargain with the federal government to keep spending down by 2 percentage points. We're seeing progress on the metrics that we're held accountable to. I think that what's important when you look at this data and you see the data start rolling out, that we don't expect that it'll be linear. We do expect that there will be times where things sort of level out a little bit before they start to improve again. I don't think people should expect just a straight line, because these are real systems of care dealing with real people with real problems, and it's not going to be linear. So as I said, emergency department visits are down 9%, primary care is up 18%. This is all, it's early data. I don't expect these numbers to stay exactly the same, but I expect the trends to stay this way. I think that this is very encouraging data for the first 9 months. This, I think, is a really important, I mean, it always amazes me, because this seems like such a basic thing to me, that we should be collecting data by race and ethnicity so that we can look at disparities and we can actually see where the disparities exist. But we don't do it. As a habit, we don't do it. So what we have with our metrics, we have made it a requirement that every metric will be collected by race and ethnicity. We'll be able to see what's happening in every area of the state, because we have every area of the state covered. So we'll be able to see where, and in fact, we even see it in the baseline data. There are areas where the data by race actually shows better numbers than it does for the Caucasian population, primarily because the local community has recognized an issue and created an initiative and proved that a focused initiative recognizing the disparity can work and can make a difference. And we want to see more of that, but we need the baseline data to understand those issues. So the Affordable Care Act. Now I'll move to that's what Oregon's doing. That's Oregon's health system transformation. It's really changing the delivery system. It's not about coverage, although that's an element of it. It's really about the actual system of care that we live in and getting the kinds of outcomes we want. The Affordable Care Act is more about, as we all know, it's more about coverage, get people covered. It's probably the largest change in healthcare in 50 years. It's since Medicare and Medicaid were developed. This, I can't begin to emphasize how important this expansion is to all of us. We estimate that, well, actually the Department of Justice estimates that about 35% of the newly eligible people in the Medicaid program will have been either prisoners or detainees at some point. These are people who now will have coverage. We can have really closely coordinated systems so that when people get released from jail or from prison, they're going right into care and right into coverage without a gap. Federal law still prevents us from providing Medicaid coverage while someone is in prison, except for hospital costs. But that coordinated care paid for by Medicaid only cuts in. It's there when they go into prison. It'll be available for them when they get out if they meet the income guidelines. That's going to be an incredible change. It means that we have another tool to help us work around recidivism. This is just a quick slide that tells, I mean, a lot of people know that the Medicaid program had two benefit packages, the OHP standard and the OHP plus package. The plus package was the one that kids were covered by and pregnant women. It's a really full, comprehensive package of benefits. The standard package, not so much. That's all gone away. There's one package now, and it's the plus package. So every Medicaid client starting January 1st will have a really comprehensive access to a comprehensive set of services. This is really exciting news. Every day on the news, we hear about Cover Oregon, and we hear that there was zero enrollments, and then there were 4,000 enrollments, and people feel badly about that, and people are working night and day to fix that and change it so that the Oregonians who want coverage will have it January 1st. But we, at the same time, we got a waiver from the federal government so that we didn't bog down the Cover Oregon even more. We asked them, we said, you know, on the food stamp side of the world, we know people who've qualified for food stamps have already gone through all the federal tests for eligibility. They've met the citizenship requirements. They've met all the requirements the feds have. So can't we look at everyone who's qualified for food stamps, who are below 138% of poverty, because that's the new eligibility threshold for Medicaid? Can we look at all of them and send them a letter and say, if you want it, come on in. You qualify for Medicaid. It's that simple. They sign the bottom of the letter and send it back to us. Well, as of yesterday, 88,000 people had replied. So there's 88,000 people as of yesterday who are eligible for new coverage under Medicaid starting the 1st of January. So there is good news in here. It's not zero enrollments. It's not a few enrollments. It's 88,000 enrollments. I expect that to be at 100,000. We sent out 260,000 letters. So I expect that number to be at 100,000. We're starting very aggressive outreach to the people who didn't respond to let them know that they need to sign those letters. And if you know anyone who received one of those letters, tell them to get it back in to us so they can get their coverage January 1. It's really, really important. And actually this last bullet I think is really stunning to me. Just on the fact that we've got coverage out to those 88,000 people means we've reduced the uninsured rate in the state by 16% already. So again, we expect to have 500,000 by the end of 2016, 500,000 people have coverage that don't have coverage today. Again, I think that thinking about the fact that a large percentage of those are people who have been in prison or have been detainees, it really is a potential life changer. I also think that these people get services paid for by local government right now that in many cases are Medicaid services. And the fact is that Medicaid will pay for some of those now, and it frees up local general fund to buy more of the services, the support services that Medicaid doesn't cover. It gives us all a real opportunity to look at housing and employment and working together in those areas in a way that we haven't been able to before. So I won't spend any time on this. I know we're trying to catch up, but I wanted to let you know, we're trying to coordinate this across several different siloed areas. We know that we have access issues. We've instituted a loan repayment program to attract providers to serve Medicaid people in Medicaid clients in underserved areas. We have tax credits and malpractice premiums for rural providers, again, to try and create access out in areas where they're underserved. We're trying to create the capacity. I think the primary way we're trying to create capacity, though, is through our patient-centered primary care homes. It is that team-based care that becomes really, really important in terms of wrapping around people and making sure that they have the kind of care, that the kind of coordinated care we all want, and connections to the wide array of services a person needs to be healthy. I think that we have a real focus on community health workers and peer-to-peer support specialists. We went through when we got permission from the federal government to do this work, we also got permission for them to reimburse that kind of worker with Medicaid dollars so that we could embed community health workers in public health departments and use them through CCOs to actually go out and do the kind of work that we've done with Malik, do the asthma screening, take a look at the situation in the home and try to alleviate those triggers. Oh, I'm doing the wrong way here. So what this means for behavioral health, many people who were on the OHP waiting list, many of people of the 260,000 that we sent letters out to are people who had mental health and substance abuse problems. So now they have an opportunity for coverage and access to services in a coordinated and continuous way that they didn't have before. I can't even begin to emphasize how important I think that is. More than half the kids in foster care have substance abuse problems. Court-mandated alcohol and drug treatment will now be covered for most patients, not all, but most patients. I think that most of this is self-evident. You know that you know this. Now that people leaving prison have an opportunity to access mental health care in a way that they didn't before, because again, they have coverage. And if we work together with the corrections and jail systems, we should be able to make sure that as people come out, they actually are going right into care. So our next steps are, from a state point of view and the state policy point of view, is we think the early evidence is very compelling for that this model works, the coordinated care model clearly works. We want to spread it to the Public Employees Benefit Board, to the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. In our new contracting, where it's not that everybody needs to enroll in a coordinated care organization, but we want anyone who bids on those contracts to be able to tell us how they're going to meet the goals of coordinated care. How are they going to deliver services better? How are they going to integrate behavioral and physical health? And they need to be able to tell us that when they respond to our request for proposals. We want to focus on equity and quality and access. We're going to continue to do that work. We're going to continue our work around transparency. We're going to continue to share best practices and try to just keep pushing these new models out. Keep letting the local communities solve these issues at the local level and sharing back with us. So again, Pam's going to talk when I get done here. This is my last slide, that about the new investments we're making in community mental health in the state. There's some really exciting new work she's going to talk about, some exciting new investments that the legislature has made. Two of those are investments that will be actually, the dollars will go into CCOs to enhance their ability to coordinate services. One around, and again, I'll let Pam talk about this, but one around assertive community treatment and really adding a lot of investment there, and one around the systems of care, the wraparound payments for the children's wraparounds, what we call it in-house anyway. So it's wrapping those additional services around kids. That's been a very really successful program, but a small piloted kind of program, and it allows us to really fund it in a much broader way. So if you want to learn more, this is where it is, health.oregon.gov. I get paid a dollar every time I say it, so I encourage everybody to go there. There is a lot of information out there, and if you want more information about the measures and the metrics and the performance of CCOs, that's where you're going to see it. So thank you.